drama never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Donald Trump is in court in New York, where he's making history as the first former US president to stand trial in a criminal case. He denies falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels, 8 years ago. Neda Taufik is outside the courthouse in Manhattan.
Inside, all of the key players are gathered in that courtroom as we await that kind of high-stakes process of selecting a jury. Donald Trump, of course, himself sitting there with both groups of his attorneys, and his campaign a spokesperson is in the room as well. Also, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, there to watch closely as his team argues this case. Of course, the stakes are incredibly high for him as well. He was the first district attorney to bring charges against Donald Trump.
The French President Emmanuel Macron says donors have promised more than $2 billion in aid for Sudan. The pledges came at a conference in Paris held on the first anniversary of the civil war. More from Elettra Naismith.
The conference had opened with a promise to end the indifference surrounding the Sudan conflict. That's now been backed by more than $2 billion that Emmanuel Macron says will support Sudan's most urgent needs. They range from vital food aid for a country on the brink of famine to education for the millions of children among those displaced. The year-long war between Sudan's army and rival paramilitaries has inflicted massive suffering, death, displacement and half the population in desperate need. The head of the UN says crimes against humanity may have been committed in what he described as a war against the Sudanese people.
US scientists say record ocean temperatures have triggered the fourth global episode of mass coral bleaching. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says coral is suffering in more than 50 countries and in all the world's oceans. Georgina Ranard has more details.
Coral is this very sensitive animal. It lives often in shallow waters, but when the water it's living in gets too hot, it gets stressed. It expels an algae that lives inside it, and then it can turn white, and often it can die. This is interesting also because we've been seeing for months these broken climate records, ocean heat driving up, and really seeing unprecedented levels of warming in the oceans.
Iran has sought to justify its unprecedented attack on Israel, telling Western countries they should appreciate its restraint. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said the strikes involving more than 300 missiles and drones were a limited act of self-defense. France, Germany and Britain are among those urging Israel to avoid any escalation. BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for two open participating member seats and one open listener sponsor seat to serve three-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at wortfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Hello, and welcome to Madison BookBeat, your home for Madison authors and authors coming to town. I'm your host, Sarah Backe, and I am brand new to the Madison BookBeat family. Normally, I will be joining you on the second Monday of the month, but due to a scheduling shift, I am here in April on the 3rd. I am thrilled to have as my first guest, local poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman, to talk about her latest collection, Exploding Head. Exploding Head is described as an OCD memoir in prose poems. It chronicles a woman's childhood onset and adult journey through obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, which manifests in fearful obsessions and counting compulsions that impact her relationship to motherhood, religion, and the larger world. It's been called magnificently propulsive and evocative by Rebecca Morgan Frank. And I wanted to make sure I mentioned this bit of praise because I love it. Megan Wildhood said, "I want someone to make a haunted house of these poems." It was published in February 2024 by Persia Books. Cynthia Marie Hoffman is the author of Exploding Head, as well as three previous collections of poetry, Sightseer, Paper Doll Fetus, and Call Me When You Want to Talk About the Tombstones. She is the recipient of a Diane Middlebrook Fellowship in Poetry at the Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing, an individual fellowship from the Wisconsin Arts Board, and a director's guest fellowship at the Civitella Ranieri Center in Italy. Cynthia has taught creative writing and composition at George Mason University, the University of Wisconsin, and Edgewood College. She works at an electrical engineering firm in Madison, Wisconsin, where she lives with her husband and teenage child. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us here, especially during National Poetry Month, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. How has the release been going for you so far?
It's been going very well. I've had a lot of events. I've been celebrating quite a bit.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a good thing to celebrate. So I have a bunch of questions about the book itself. But before we dive into that, I would love to take the opportunity, just because it is National Poetry Month, to maybe talk a little bit about poetry and kind of how you got started with it, what it means to you. So when did you first begin writing?
I began writing when I was a very little child.
Yes.
I wrote with my mother, and I have wonderful memories of sitting with her and telling stories or coming up with little rhymes that I would write down, or she would write down even before I could write. And then we would draw pictures together and illustrate together. So truly, I should have grown up to be an artist or a children's book author. But poetry always appealed to me. I did love the rhyming. Of course, none of my poems rhyme now that I'm an adult.
It's funny how that works.
My horizons have expanded. But poetry in that way, I think, has always been a part of my life.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I love that it's sort of a family, born out of a family tradition.
My mother has always had a very musical way of speaking. And I think that that always, and I'll talk about that in terms of the obsessive compulsive disorder in my collection, Exploding Head, but my love of language and the obsessive compulsive disorder kind of made me hyper aware of syllabics and the musicality of language and speech.
Yeah.
And my father was a grammarian. He really loved, if anyone dare say anything wrong, he would love to correct them.
Yes.
So I learned a lot.
Yeah. There's sort of like two kind of warring factions,
yes,
a little bit, or two different ways of looking at language. So,
and
oh, that's
I think
fun.
I inherited them both.
Yeah,
which is
yeah,
good.
Yes. So it sounds like maybe you kind of got started with poetry, or did you get there gradually? Did you try other things along the way?
I always wrote poetry, and I wrote some pretty terrible poetry throughout high school. I had a best friend. She and I wrote poems together and shared our journals and our notebooks. And later, I did write stories. I always thought that I would write a novel, or I have drafted a novel. It sits in a drawer. but after a while, I think I just thought, I'm a poet. I'm going to label myself a poet. Yeah. And unfortunately, that meant that I shut some doors on myself that I'm just now opening again. Recently, this past year, I thought, I'm going to reimagine my genre and what I can possibly do. And I started writing some more personal essays, which I always used to love.
Yeah.
So that's felt good.
Okay, great. Yeah. Yeah, I think you can kind of feel a little bit of that progression in the book already, since they are prose poems, you know, as opposed to what we may think of as more traditional, you know, kind of the form of poetry. But
yes, each poem is a little paragraph.
It is.
Little paragraph.
Right. can you remember the first poem you ever wrote?
No. I surely wish I could. Probably something about a leaf or a teddy bear. One of those little cutesy rhymed things.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, if you started that young, it's maybe a little tough to remember something that specific.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you like most about writing poetry?
I think it allows me to figure things out. And I think I, as a poet, process experiences through poetry. I find out what I believe. I find out how I feel about certain things by writing through it. And a lot of people will do the same with journals or, you know, keeping a diary.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's similar, although I am intentionally crafting my words and my discoveries toward an assumed audience who would, you know, if I were publishing it in a journal or in a book, I'm thinking about what I want to communicate to others.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So you think of it as sort of confessional in a way, or?
Well, it's an interesting experience for me because, like I was talking about those very bad high school poems I was writing, those were very personal, very confessional. You know, you write down your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in college, I started writing about things that were outside of my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And my previous three collections prior to Exploding Head are primarily based on research.
Interesting.
My first collection, Sightseer, is a collection of travel poems, and there are my personal experiences of traveling through Europe in that book.
Okay.
But a lot of it is based on research about the countries and the buildings and the architecture and the history.
Wow. Yeah.
And my second collection is also a researched collection about midwifery and birth through history.
Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love that. I mean, poetry has the ability to be all of those things at once, right?
Yeah. I think maybe I'm really a novelist at heart, but I prefer little snippets of language at a time.
Yeah.
But I enjoy sitting down and having that extended experience focused on a topic where I'm writing a book about something and it takes me 5 years.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And you found kind of poetry is the best sort of medium for that so far.
I think so. And also, I just don't know how novelists do it. I'm sure sure they come up with similar, you know, workarounds in their lives, but as a parent and a, you know, someone with a full-time job outside of academia, you know, I don't get summers off or breaks or so I have to find little ways to work language into my day, and poetry allows for that because it is in smaller snippets.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What would you say you find to be the most challenging aspect of writing poetry?
All of it. For someone who loves language and loves poetry, of course, as an art form, my medium is words, language.
Mm.
For someone who loves language so much, it is the hardest part of my day, even coming up with words, thinking of the right thing. And in fact, usually I begin with an idea or an image that I see in my head.
Mm.
And the last thing to come is the language to describe it.
Yeah.
So I always feel like I've already got something formed and the language has to come later. Whereas I think a lot of poets enter into a poem through language,
yeah.
or they hear or think of a line mm-hmm. that sounds musical or interesting.
Right.
And that almost never happens to me.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's really interesting. So you start with sort of something you've seen or something that's sort of kind of formed in your head, and you need to figure out a way to get it onto the page.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so it's already preformed in my mind, and it's never going to be the way I truly see it.
Yeah, right.
through language.
Right.
Language is always the filter I have to express things through.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think that's great. And poetry kind of offers, you know, there's so many possibilities to how that thing could be described, that, you know, poetry is part of the work of finding that.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I love taking a sentence and writing it down mm-hmm. in as many different ways as I can.
Yeah.
Like moving the phrases around and thinking about, you know, you could choose a single sentence and write mm-hmm. down a list of 5 or 6, 7 or 8 different ways to say the same idea.
Oh, yeah.
And that fascinates me.
Yeah. I mean, and then how do you decide what's the perfect one?
That's why they say a poem is never done. It's only abandoned. At some point, you got to give up and move on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope we can talk a little bit later about how you figure that out. But before we dive into the collection itself, I want to just ask if you have any influences and what you enjoy about poetry as a reader.
I would say my influences vary depending on what I'm working on at the time. It's mm-hmm. It's hard to think of what has impacted you until you're done writing it and you see,
yeah.
oh gosh, this is reflected here.
Yeah, sure.
When I first went to George Mason for my graduate program, other poets were reading my work in the classroom and saying, oh, I see influences of Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, which was so fascinating to me because I had never read them at that time.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I was reading, you know, one of my biggest influences is probably Carolyn Forché, who taught at George Mason.
Oh, yeah.
I had her as an undergraduate, which was an amazing experience. And she opened me up to a lot of poetry in translation, poetry written during World War II, poetry of witness.
Sure.
And so those were my influences.
Yeah.
And it was funny to me that someone would see Anne Sexton in my work. So it's very interesting to see how things, you know, come inside you or how other people see their own influences
yeah,
in your work.
Definitely, definitely. And how things are just sort of, I don't know, in the ether. Or,
yes, I think
know.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
Absorbed.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Oh, I love that idea of poetry in translation and kind of reading that, because that's just another whole, I mean, that opens up so many more questions about language and meaning and, because of course, originally it, you know, probably had different cadences or, you know, just sounded different or felt different, and reading something in English and thinking in about that way. That's a really interesting way to approach poetry.
It's really interesting to read poetry in translation, especially from those poets we know well and who have been translated by multiple translators.
Sure,
so
yeah.
So you can actually read different versions of mm-hmm. the same poem
yeah.
in English.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, so let's not waste any more time, and we can dive right into Exploding Head. I would love if you would read a poem for us to sort of set the tone.
Sure. I will read a poem, since I talked a little bit already about how obsessive compulsive disorder caused me to pay extra attention to language. Mm. This is a poem early in the collection about that. The music of language is clamping down hard. Your sister has spotted the woodpecker through the kitchen window. Every thought has a rhythm. The window, like all windows, has 6 lines. The lines around the outside and the X you draw in your mind, corner to corner. The forest is a thick enchantment of green. You're in your bare feet. Everyone leans toward the glass. You are just a girl in the summertime, drawing the window in your mind. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then the red flash of bird. Isn't he humongous, your mother says. Big as a cat. Isn't he humongous, works on the window. put the words on the window. The woodpecker clutches the feeder, swinging by a rope. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Think again. Isn't he humongous? At your shoulder, your sister is normal, simple. But the music of language is opening up for you. The music of language is clamping down hard. When the woodpecker is gone, two slender birds sit together on a branch, facing opposite directions, marking an X with their tails in the wide green glass.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was a great one to select just because it encapsulates so many things about your book that I really loved. Music of language, of course, and then all the wildlife that's in the book as well. But I'd love to start just kind of at the beginning. And what was the first seed of the book for you?
I think the first seed was realizing at about age 35, and I'm 48, 49 now, that it was time for me to start talking about OCD. Mm-hmm. And I really hadn't talked about it at all most of my life. Mm-hmm. Most of my obsessions and compulsions are mental. So that's something that's going on with me internally that mm-hmm. other people wouldn't necessarily recognize or have to know unless I shared. So I was very isolated most of my life dealing with this alone. Mm-hmm. And I think I finally, the loneliness caught up with me. And I finally thought, it's time for me to tell my story. Yeah. You know, after writing three other books, mostly about other people's stories, it was time for me to write those personal poems again.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you remember what the first poem you wrote for the book was?
I don't. Mm. I don't remember. And I wish I could. But what I do remember was, and very vividly remember, was bringing that first poem or first two poems to my poetry group. Mm. And I used to have, I still do, but at that time, I had a collection of poets who would come over and sit around my dining room table. We would all bring printouts of our work and share with each other and critique and yeah. feedback. And I remember saying, I'm writing about something new. I want to share, but I'm not ready to talk about what it is yet. Mm. And that was easy enough to do because I don't say obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD anywhere in any of the poems.
Right.
So we kind of took it at face value, and they were a very supportive group.
Yeah.
And we just talked about, you know, what was going on in the world of the poems that I was creating.
Yeah.
It was a nice safe space.
Right, yeah, and it's always good to have those kinds of things as a writer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when did you know you had a whole collection then?
I think I always intended it to be a collection.
Yeah.
Because I'm always writing a book rather than yeah. writing a poem.
Sure.
So I'm pretty headstrong in that way. And I have actually abandoned books in the past
okay.
that I've written many poems toward and realized this isn't working.
Oh, wow.
Which is a risk you take when you, it's again, like the novelist. It's a risk
yeah.
you take when you work on a collection that's a subject, you know, a single subject matter. It can't really be broken out and filtered into the next manuscript. It's a story.
Yeah,
so
right.
I just kind of pushed headstrong until it was a book.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so interesting. So you sort of think of it as a whole when you start out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think of it in terms of the project that I want to work on next.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, not just because of OCD, but yeah. because of my language. I love the idea of being obsessed with something, you know,
yeah.
going really deep on a single topic
sure.
for a number of years.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you talked a little bit about this as your previous collections were sort of more research-based. So I'm guessing how you approached Exploding Head was maybe a little bit different than what you did with those previous books, or maybe not. I mean, I'd love to hear just what the process was like for you.
It was very different, actually, because I had to resist my natural urge and tendency toward research.
Mm.
And I wanted to really focus on creating the world inside my head so that I could say, hey, here's what it's like in here.
Yeah, right.
And so it felt very important to me to not label it, to not say that it was OCD in the poems,
mm-hmm.
and to not bring out bring in external stories that were someone else's or research or, you know, what I tend to do is go out and grab a bunch of facts and, you know, how does OCD work? And I really resist, I had to intentionally resist that in order to create this really visceral, clear vision of my internal experience that I kept so isolated for years. I wanted the book to feel like that.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely does. But it must have been, for me, that sounds like it would be very challenging to kind of reach that deeply into yourself. I write fiction, so I'm a little bit on the other side of, you know, I'm sort of deliberately not writing about myself. So that sort of excavation work sounds a little intimidating. So I don't know, was that how, kind of how it felt for you?
I think it was both intimidating and liberating to finally say some of these things and to have the space to say them in a way that I had complete control over. I have complete control over what I put on that page. Yeah. I think the most challenging thing has been talking about the book as the book has come out. Sure. There was a point at which I had to determine what the back cover copy would say on the back of the book. Sure. I knew what the poems would be, but at some point during the publication process, we have to write that little description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was the moment where I thought, okay, am I going to say this is a collection of poems about OCD?
Yeah.
Or not?
Right.
And because I wanted the experience to be so true and visceral, I wanted anyone to feel like they could experience the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want it to be, I didn't want that label to shut doors.
Sure.
So I did, however, decide that it was very important to label it because I was also being misdiagnosed by people who didn't recognize what the disorder was that was on the page. And OCD is very widely misunderstood. Mm-hmm. I think the scope of it is not known by most people in popular culture. We think of it as hand washing, or which it can be a part of, a quite devastating part of OCD, but that's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it can also be, you know, really violent, scary, intrusive thoughts. It's not just wanting to have an alphabetized spice rack, you know,
or
like no crumbs on the counter. I mean, there are crumbs on my counter probably right now. So it was important to me to take control over my own story by labeling it a collection of poems about OCD.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also important to me to finally speak up.
Yeah. So did you sort of feel like you had to be an ambassador sort of what you were going through, or, you know, because as you say, a lot of people kind of don't understand or they misunderstand things about this. So did you struggle with that kind of representing your own experience versus this is what it is, you know, sort of thing?
I think it's been hard for me to figure out how to position myself in relation to that. Of course, I can't represent, I think I'm pretty clear in my own mind in knowing that I can't represent all of OCD, that it is so widely varied, and there's just such a range of experiences. So I can only speak to my own personal lived experience.
Yeah.
And I think since my collection focuses on that so much and doesn't reach out toward language about OCD very often, or out in the wider world of recommending therapy, or, you know, like what that journey looks like, I've really tried to just keep the mirror on myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you sort of, like the narrator of the poems in this, you kind of think of as yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. So it is very much a kind of, well, they're all in first person.
Right. Well, they're in second person,
actually.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm saying you do this, you do that.
Right.
And it's very interesting. I have a kind of complicated relationship with the second person. Because at some point, you know, well, first of all, it's something that people often do. They're triggered into using when they're speaking about a traumatic thing that has occurred to them, where halfway through the story, they will change to the second person and say, you were walking down the street when this happened. When they're really talking about themselves. So it's a way of just, we all do it as humans, as kind of a way of creating a distance between ourselves and the trauma that we experienced. And I think also for me, as having had OCD, there was a book called Brain Lock, in which there was a little rhymey chant you were supposed to say that goes, "It's not me, it's my OCD."
Okay.
And you were supposed to repeat that. And it's a great catchy little way of reminding yourself that you are not your intrusive thoughts.
Mm.
You know, you are safe. You are not going to harm anyone. You know, that doesn't mean that the intrusive thoughts reflect your values. You are separate from your OCD.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember encountering that book in my 20s and thinking, but if it's not me, who is it? Because I feel like OCD is me. I am who I am because of my years of experience, especially my childhood, you know, dealing with it in an isolated fashion and not sharing with anyone. It's made me who I am today.
Yeah.
And it's not all negative either. It's you know, my love of poetry and language, I think, really comes from some of the obsessions and compulsions
Sure.
I had when I was a child.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that comes through a lot in the book. I mean, as you were just saying, the book covers a pretty remarkable breadth of time. I mean, we go from childhood all the way to basically present day. What was it like for you to revisit those earlier years?
I think it was much easier for me to write about childhood
really?
Than it was for me to write about adulthood. And I think just because I'm still in it, you know, I'm still an adult. It's harder to see clearly what's happening to me now.
Yeah.
And childhood was for me such a magical time. And, you know, I was surrounded by love and friends and family, but I was also just terribly alone.
Mm.
And so I had this already rich world that I had existed in that only I knew as a child, kind of like a fantasy world in a way.
Yeah.
Although it wasn't a healthy fantasy world, it was OCD. I didn't know. But it was wonderful for me to be able to share it. And to be able to, you know, recreate some memories from my childhood in a way that told my story that no one else knew.
Yeah.
And adulthood was harder.
Okay. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think I was also really looking for an arc in the manuscript. Like, we want poetry collections to move from point A to point B in some way across the pages if you read them from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And I was looking for that arc of healing. Like, can I write about OCD if I'm not healed, if I'm not cured?
Yeah.
Of course, there is no cure for OCD.
Right.
But I really struggled with that. And I thought, okay, I'm going to take all the poems that are about my fear of guns and put them all together and see where the arc is.
Yeah.
Am I less afraid of guns? You know, am I less afraid of all these other things that I talk about in the book? And the answer I kept coming up with was no, it's not, you know, it's not better.
Yeah.
So I finally decided to just simply put the poems in chronological order, which I hadn't written them in chronological order. And it took a lot of revision to be able to put them back from childhood to adulthood.
Yeah.
But as I did that and I read it, I discovered there was an arc of healing that I wasn't giving myself credit for.
Yeah.
That I had been speaking about myself with more self-compassion, with more self-awareness, and more tools to help manage OCD.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that, you know, comes through. I mean, a lot of the recurring kind of images in the book reminded me a lot, as you're mentioning, sort of childhood, the sort of fairy tale quality that they have. There are a lot of forests. There's a lot of wildlife and geese and frogs and cattails and things like that. There's also smoke. There's also fire. And then there's an angel that kind of keeps visiting you as well. You know, and to me, they sort of were reminiscent of the stories, you know, we kind of are told when we're children. And then in turn, as we get older, we tell our own children. And I just was sort of fascinated by how, you know, you incorporated a lot of those images and how they kind of shifted and changed as the book went on. So, you know, you sort of touched on this, but what kind of drew you to these images? And I'm interested in the angel in particular, if you want to talk about that.
Sure. The angel is, I had always viewed the angel as part of my OCD.
Okay.
And it fit in the book to me because the angel is a figure who just appeared in my bedroom one day when I was a child, or at night, really. And it was always there in my bedroom, just kind of this hulking glow by the closet door. Yeah. You know, it probably literally was the closet door, but my five-year-old mind, you know, envisioned this presence, and I felt it so strongly. And the angel figure came with rules that felt very similar to the rules that come with OCD.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't continue counting something, or if I don't cover my ear with the sheet, the angel is going to lean over my bed and whisper into my ear the secret of heaven, which I don't know why that was terrifying, but it terrified me, and I did not want to know whatever the secret of heaven was, or whatever my understanding of that was when I was a child. It was terrifying.
Yeah.
And the angel stayed with me my whole life until I started writing about it. Which was really strange. I mean, that angel came with me to college. It was in my bedroom at night, you know, even, you know, growing up and having my own child and having my husband. The angel was always kind of clicked into place every night by the closet door until I wrote poems about the angel in my book and shared them with people. I noticed he was just gone.
Huh.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
Like, I had some feelings to work through with that as well, because that was something that, although it was terrifying, it had accompanied me my whole life. Yeah. It was a presence that had been there in the same way that OCD made me who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, the angel was always there with me.
Yeah. Do you have a poem that features the angel that you would read for us?
Sure. There's a series of angel poems, actually, that move throughout the book, and I could read the first one in which the angel first appears.
Please.
The angel stands in your room, its presence a dense swelling in the dark. You lie in bed. You are afraid of angels. You sleep. You wake. The angel wants its whisper swirling in your ear. If it gets the chance, the angel leans over the bed. You wake. You sleep. Your pale ear glows in the dark, a whirl of petals parading the tunnel to your child brain. Cover your ear. You have been chosen. The angel is going to tell you the secret of heaven. Bury your ear in the quilt. The angel never leaves you. You sleep, you wake, one ear in the pillow, one ear in the quilt. The angel breathes. What else can you do? The quilt is a field of tiny pink flowers.
Thank you. So, you know, we haven't talked much about, you know, the particularity of the language here. You know, as the first, I think the first poem you read used that the music of language was part of the title and is said in the poem itself to sort of describe what's going on in your head. And a lot of these poems to me felt very musical in how they use rhythm and, you know, things like alliteration and the number repetition to kind of capture what it's like to live with this compulsion every day. Another line that I wrote down that I particularly loved was, the mind is a muscular tongue that never tires, which has such a nice, you know, feel to it. A lot of these I really just kind of enjoyed reading aloud to myself because of just the language and how it sort of, you know, communicates, you know, what's going on with you. And it kind of made me think as OCD as sort of something that has its own like vernacular or lexicon to it. And I wondered if that was something you were kind of consciously trying to evoke for your reader.
I think there's a lot of similarity between poetry and OCD in the lexicon, you know? It's really incantatory. It's repetition.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the musicality. I have a poem in the collection called Syllabics. So I'm thinking of counting syllables, which is something that you do in poetry as well as for me with OCD, kind of catching little bits and snippets of language and repeating them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, as part of my experience with OCD, can be very frustrating and get in the way of me accomplishing tasks. But in terms of poetry, it can be a benefit. You know, yeah. I'm counting the syllables. I'm very aware of the rhythm of language. And I do also read my poems out loud.
Sure, yeah.
Quite a bit. And they are in the prose poem form. So since it's just a paragraph, I think I need to spend extra attention to the musicality and the rhythm of the sentences rather than in a lineated poem with line breaks.
Yeah.
You know, the line is sort of your breath. And in the prose poem, it's more the sentence. So a long poem, a long sentence followed by a short sentence, et cetera. That kind of rhythm play is very interesting to me.
Right. And sort of the variance in how long the paragraphs are as well.
Yes. It's hard to sustain a longer paragraph in a prose poem, I think, because it's so condensed. It's just so dense and it just looks like a big chunk of text on the page.
Right.
Big, heavy, dark block.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Which is interesting as like a visual to think about, just with the subject of the book too, right? Sort of like a block in the head almost.
Yes. I really did feel that the prose poem form recreated how OCD feels in my mind. Like this tight, dense, condensed space where there's no breath, there's no break. Mm-hmm. It's just thoughts on top of thoughts on top of thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's great. I mean, one of the most amazing things to me about poetry is how poets use the space on the page. And I think your book does that in really interesting ways. So you sort of talked about how you had an arc in mind, or you were thinking about what it could be, you know, as you were writing. And it does feel like we sort of end, you know, in a place of peace, or at least, you know, not resolution per se, because as you said, it can be hard to kind of resolve something like this. So, you know, as you were working through the book, did you sort of rearrange things? I mean, you said you had kind of originally thought maybe you would put them together as subjects, sort of, and then that changed as you went on.
Yeah, I think when I'm putting poems that I've written together based on subject, that's me investigating what am I saying about X subject. You know, like there is a fear of guns that runs throughout the poems.
Yeah.
And so I would be, for example, looking at five poems about guns and thinking, what's the storyline here? Mm-hmm. You know, like each, you know, they're almost like characters in a show where each character has its own storyline. So I was looking for the gun storyline, the angel storyline, what's the resolution?
Right.
And I kept asking that of myself, what is the resolution? You know, and you did ask earlier, when did you know you had a book?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what it's pinned on for me is, what is the arc? What is the resolution?
Yeah.
What am I getting to? And I kept saying, I'm not getting to anything. I'm not better. You know, like somehow having a book was equated in my mind falsely to the idea of getting better. That I couldn't write about it unless I had, you know, gone to adequate therapy and healed enough, which is just not correct. You know, you can continue to write about things while you're in the midst of them. That's how we work through things. That's how we discover things. And in fact, it was a healing journey for me to write and then correctly, for myself, correctly organize the poems in an order that showed me I was healing more than I had thought. Yeah. And I did at a point, once I thought to put them in chronological order and I recognized that I was nicer to myself as I got older and I was less alone and just the language was already there. It was already just this kind voice kind of coming through that I didn't even think I had.
Yeah.
It was evident in the poems I had written. And so I did intentionally write toward that a little bit more and think, okay, I can use some of the language of OCD, like language that's associated with the disorder, like intrusive, and the idea of like sitting with uncertainty.
Yeah.
You know, one of the final poems in my book is called Uncertainty, and it, you know, talks about that idea. So really demonstrating how I've used those concepts and those tools to manage it.
Right. Yeah. Which are, you know, concepts and ideas that are sort of, you know, been co-opted in certain ways by like the wellness movement or what have you. Sometimes for good, obviously, and, you know, sometimes for not so good or not so helpful. So do you sort of think about the book as, I mean, I have to assume that you hope it's helpful in some ways to your readers.
I do. And it's interesting because while I was thinking about whether I should put OCD or not on the back cover of the book, which obviously I decided I would, then it kind of became this little catchphrase, like elevator pitch for my book. It's an OCD memoir in prose poems. And I tend to toss that out left and right as I'm talking about my book, thinking when I say OCD memoir, it's going to spark a full real world of the range of possibilities of what OCD might be. You're going to expect to see car accidents, drownings, fear of guns, magical angels, you know, forests and this whole world.
Yeah.
And I have to keep reminding myself that really people aren't aware. Many people are not aware of the true nature and scope of what OCD can contain. You know, that these are not just poems about, you know, some of the main tropes that we see on TV shows where OCD is often used as a, you know, to get laughs. You know, someone's doing something that looks like a quirky behavior trait.
Yeah.
But part of the problem is when we see things on TV, we're only seeing usually the compulsion, the acted thing, like continuing to lock the door a bunch of times.
Right.
We're not really given a view to the inside of, like, what is the reason for doing this? This person is really, this is not funny. This person is really scared and trying to control something, that there is a fear at work inside.
Yeah.
So I think that in some ways, calling it an OCD memoir has opened doors. And in other ways, I worry that it closes doors, that people have a preconceived notion of what my book is going to be.
Sure.
And that's just not at all what it is.
Yeah.
So I have a hard time trying to communicate, no, but really. There's all this really wild stuff in here, you know, that I think is pretty crazy. And you know, not that poetry has to be entertaining, but in a sense, I feel like it's pretty entertaining.
It's nice when it is, right?
Yes.
So what's the response been like from readers?
So far, it's been really good. And I have had a handful of people who have been kind enough to reach out to me and say, wow, this book makes me feel seen.
Yeah.
And for someone who wrote this book because I isolated myself and never shared, the idea that I could write something from, you know, that place of just being an island my whole life and make connections with others and for others has just been a gift.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful to hear. That's one of the great things about writing is, you know, you do it alone often, and then it's suddenly out in the world and you realize sort of what it means to others. And that's kind of a special thing.
And we don't often hear from people who are our readers, especially in the poetry world. So for those few who've reached out to me, it's just been so meaningful.
Yeah. Well, I'd love, we have, you know, in the final few moments that we have together, since you are a local, and this is obviously a show that has a local focus, I'd love to just chat a little bit about, you know, what it's like being a writer in Madison and, you know, what your kind of daily writing life is like. So why don't we just start there? How long have you been in Madison?
Almost 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I came up here as a fellow at University of Wisconsin.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And the Diane Middlebrook Fellowship. So that's post master's degree. And you get an opportunity to teach and interact with other fellows and the professors at UW.
Yeah.
And that was just a wonderful welcome to Madison. And I wish I had known when I first arrived that I would stay, that I was going to be staying.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's only a one-year appointment. And I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I have to apply to jobs. Where am I going next? You know, and 20 years later, we're still here.
Yeah.
But it is just a fabulous place to be if you're a writer. There are so many resources. The Arts and Lit Lab, for example.
Yeah, right.
And not too far from here, the Driftless Writing Center. There are just so many centers and opportunities for classes.
Yeah.
The Madison Writers Studio. There's just a great sense of community.
Yeah.
So you need not certainly be associated with the university or have a degree at all to write.
Yeah.
And to also take community classes. There are fabulous classes offered at the Arts and Lit Lab by poets who are associated with UW, who are teaching the same thing to the students
sure,
at UW.
Yeah.
So, and I have just worked really hard to build a community for myself as well with poetry groups, having other people who read my work and I get to read their work. And over the years, we, you know, develop this deep understanding of each other's, like what we're trying to do with our work has been so important. And also in your regular day, no one cares if you write a poem. Like, there was a period of about 5 years where I didn't write at all.
Yeah.
And
The
only reason I started writing again was because, and I was halfway through Exploding Head at the time, and I just kind of abandoned it. I'm not a poet anymore. You know, the whole thing. And I was just busy parenting a young child,
sure,
and I was busy at work, and it was just hard to keep it up. But I had a poetry friend who said, let's start a group up again, you know, and I was like, I'm not a writer, but I'll join. And of course, I started writing again.
Yeah.
Just having that sense of community, I think, is so important because, as you mentioned, you know, it can be very isolating to be a writer.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, it's so special when you can find those people who you feel like really get you.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a teacher as well. How does that kind of fit into your writing life? Do you find it inspiring?
Well, I actually haven't taught in a while, although I did just teach a class online on the prose poem.
Oh, wonderful.
Which was really fun.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me that I haven't taught in a while. It's very, you know, I did teach for a while before I decided I'm just going to settle in at this engineering firm where I work. It's a consulting firm. I've been there for about 17 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's been easier for me to be creative in the off hours after this job than it was when I was teaching. And I think it's just because I always wanted to be a teacher. Teaching is so, it was so rewarding for me. And I was really sacrificing everything else in my life for teaching.
Yeah.
And those students, you know, was like all I cared about. And I know that people who teach for a number of years find that balance. It's hard. It's hard. But I think when I'm not doing something necessarily creative during the day, I still have creative energy left over for my own work at night.
Right. Yeah. I think that's really true, especially since teaching these days requires so much beyond just being in the classroom. And, you know, you have to, and you end up spending a lot of time working on other people's stuff, which, as you said, can be very inspiring and wonderful. But I do love that, you know, you mentioned in your bio and you just mentioned now that you work for an engineering firm, because, you know, I also work like a very standard kind of 9-to-5. And I think it's kind of so important to mention that sort of labor that you have to do to live the life of a writer these days, you know, because people seem to have a lot of misconceptions about what it looks like to be a writer.
I think so. And again, I think that's like the mix of my parents coming out again. Like, you know, and my dad, he was very creative as well. Like, he grew up singing and acting in the theater and, you know, performing. Oh, wow. He played trombone. He, you know, is in the church choir, all kinds of things. But he was always like, you need to get a job to make money. It doesn't have to be, you know, like, that's not who you are.
Right.
Your job is not your identity.
Yeah.
And so it really opened up some doors for me in a way of thinking, you know, I'm not going to make money writing poetry. I need a job for money.
Yeah, right.
And that's okay. You know, like, not everything has to be your identity.
Right.
And the one thing that satisfies you. You can be creative. No one's stopping you from being creative. You can be creative anytime.
Yeah. No, that's so true. And it's such a good point that, you know, when you have to take on that additional work, sometimes it helps when it's, you know, something that's not creative at all. And that sort of allows you to hold on to that energy.
Yeah.
You know?
Vice versa. Like, creative energy that I invest in my poetry doesn't suck the energy out that I need for my work.
Yeah.
So I'm fresh for both my work and my creative work.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you have a pretty good balance of things.
It's not easy.
So what's next for you?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
last year, I started writing essays, and I'm really excited about essays, personal essays, telling my story in a different genre. I have also been writing new poems, and I have, 45 or so, the bulk of a manuscript, but I still feel like it's not a book yet. Mm. It's like, what am I writing about?
Sure.
And people keep telling me, Cynthia, this is how most people write. You write poems and you're really generally exploring themes, even when you don't realize you are.
Sure.
When you sit down and read it all, you think, oh, I was thinking about parenting and, my own parents aging and things like that. They just pop up.
Sure.
But I feel uncomfortable without a theme. Without that book that I'm building.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Maybe it'll be a collection of essays next.
Okay, great. Well, we'll look forward to it, whatever it might be. I'd love to invite you to close by maybe reading one more poem for us.
Sure. I think I will read Uncertainty since great. I talked about it a little bit. It's toward the end. Uncertainty. You will only be cured of the uncertainty about your own death after you die. So what good does it do? Tonight, the rabbits run in the wet grass, white tails bobbing like lifeboats on turbulent seas. You are invited to sit with uncertainty. Sit in this porch chair in need of paint by the prickly weeds fattening in the garden. Everywhere, the great unknown is murmuring. Today, walking barefoot through the yard, you found tufts of fur, a curl of entrails from which a single red berry had tumbled. You tried opening a door for the ghosts to shuttle through, but they held tight to the shadows. You always blocked your ears anyway, humming like the child you still are against the truth you refuse to hear. You cannot go on flinching at each small thing. See how the rabbits ride the current, trimming the sails of their ears to the wind. Surely the dead had a good last meal. Surely that berry broke a bright tang against her teeth.
Beautiful. I've been speaking with Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman. We've been talking about her new book, Exploding Head. It's an OCD memoir in prose poems, chronicling one woman's journey from childhood onset to adulthood. The book is now available from Persia Books, and you can find it at your local bookshop or online. Cynthia, how can listeners find out more about you? Do you have social media accounts or
a
website?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram, and I'm just Cynthia Marie Hoffman. And you can find me on my website, cynthiamariehoffman.com.
Excellent. Any upcoming events you want to plug?
I'll be at the Ridges and Rivers Festival in Viroqua toward the end of the month, and a couple of things in Chicago later this month
as well. Wonderful, yes. You've been listening to Madison BookBeat. I'm your host, Sarah Batke. Join me next on May 8th in my usual second week of the month slot for an interview with Beth Wynn about her memoir, Owner of a Lonely Heart. Thank you to Andrew Thomas for running the soundboard today, to news director Sholly Pittman, and to you for listening. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next is a 3-hour set of all-around jazz with Alex Wilding White. But first, some announcements.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Please join us on Monday, April 15 at 7 p.m. for a very special Access Hours. We are proud to present
Turning Points.
Students' Voice Forum is high school.
We are a diverse student's body. We hope some dreams.
We come from across the globe.
We are your neighbors.
We are your friends.
We are your children.
We are here with you and we invite you to hear our story.
That's Monday, April 15 from 7 to 8 p.m. on the Access or
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 8th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions, this week in music history for April 8th. On April 8th, 1994, The Offspring's third album, Smash, was released. Smash is in contention for the best-selling indie release of all time, and for good reason. Its sound was tempered just enough to suit the masses, while the energy and themes resonated with the kids at the time. After its heyday in the 70s and early 80s, punk's popularity faded, giving rise to subgenres like ska punk, hardcore, and grunge. Grunge in particular took off with Nirvana's Nevermind in 1991. Oddly enough, Kurt Cobain was found dead on April 8, 1994, the same day Smash was released. The thirsty earholes of the masses were obviously not satisfied with wallowing in the self-doubt, abuse, neglect, and betrayal so prominent in many of the grungy songs.